Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
It's very instructive to look at a work produced in 1766, the third edition of the influential Universal Dictionary of Trade and Commerce by Malachy Postlethwaite, an active writer on economic issues. He added in that edition a dedication to George Nelson, the Lord Mayor of London, and to its aldermen and councillors. And this was a dedication that affirmed the centrality of London. Quote, "London tradesmen appear to constitute the very active soul of the commerce of the whole British state, and they are an essential medium between the merchant, the country shopkeeper, and the consumers. Of such high concernment are the London tradesmen to the whole traffic of the nation, that all our native commodities and manufactures, almost of every sort, more or less, centre at first in London, and amongst the London tradesmen, brought to them from all the inland manufacturing and trading towns and cities throughout the kingdom, where those commodities and manufactures are not made or produced. The countrymen shear their sheep, sell their wool, and carry it from place to place. The manufacturer sets it to work, combing, spinning, winding, twisting, dyeing, weaving, fulling, dressing, and thus they furnish their numberless manufactures in the whole woolen branch. But what must they do with them if London did not take them first off their hands? And the London tradesmen, warehousemen, factors, and wholesale dealers did not vend and circulate them amongst the London merchants, as well as to all the remote parts of the nation. London is the grand central mart to which the gross body of all our native commodities are first brought, and from whence they are again sold. This is the case, be it Manchester for the cotton wares or Yorkshire for coarse cloth and kerseys, etc., both of them full types of textiles, etc. Now, this was an exaggeration of London's economic centrality, but nevertheless, the market and finance of London was central to English economic activity. Earlier, for example, in his tour through the whole island of Great Britain, published between 1724 and 1726, Daniel Defoe had provided an account of Ipswich, which drew attention to the very problem posed for that town by the commercial strength of London. He described Ipswich as swallowed up by the immense indraft of trade to the city of London. If it be otherwise at this town, with some other towns which are lately increased in trade and navigation, wealth and people, while their neighbours decay, it is because they have some particular trade or accident to trade, which is a kind of nostrum to them, inseparable to the place, and which fixes there by the nature of the thing, as the herring fishery to Yarmouth, the coal trade to Newcastle, the Leeds clothing trade, the export of butter and lard, and the great corn trade for Holland is to Hull, the Virginia and West India trade at Liverpool, the Irish trade to Bristol, and the like. But what he's saying is that unless you have some specific trade like that, you're in trouble, and you're going to lose wealth to London. London, of course, was also significant in influencing notions of urban life, although there was also much provincial autonomy. London squares, for example, were imitated in towns such as Bristol. As an aspect, both of these notions and of an underlying reality, London posed also the greatest problems of law and order and of social conditions. London's, of course, dominant position owed something to the enormous growth of its trade, but also reflected its role as the centre of government, the law and consumption, and its dominance of the world of print, which became even more important as a shaper of news, opinion and fashion. Political programmes were conceived and debated in London, which of course was the seat of the court, the legislature, the executive, the judiciary. London's newspapers circulated throughout the country. London-based insurance companies such as the Sun Fire Office and banks played a role across the country. And indeed, on top of that, there was considerable development within London of buildings that became iconic. Most obviously, with the St Paul's Cathedral, begun in 1675, consecrated in 1697, and declared officially complete in 1711. Far from looking to rebuild the old Gothic cathedral, this borrowed the style of church architecture seen in Baroque Rome and did so for the Church of England and made London clearly different in that respect. Other cities in England had Gothic cathedrals. No city had anything to match St Paul. So London, nor for that matter, did any other city had anything to match the new bridges being built across the River Thames, Westminster Bridge, Blackfriars Bridge, nor did they have, for example, anything to match the West End, nor did they have anything to match, for example, public buildings such as the Bank of England. So London was a model, but also different in some respects, not just by its scale, but by its content to the other towns in England. And, you know, there are a number of categories of those: regional capitals such as Norwich and Nottingham, county centres such as Warwick, developing entertainment centres, particularly spa towns such as Tunbridge Wells, Scarborough, Bristol Hot Wells and Bath. And these were interesting, these places, because they reflected a leisure provision in which the elite did not simply have to go to the court at London. They reflected an alternative, a different alternative to that offered by a port like Liverpool, but an alternative. 34 new spas were founded between 1700 and 1750, and even more in the second half of the century. For all of these towns, there was a measure of copying to a degree what happened in London, but also pressing for difference. And I mean, this was picked up by commentators of the period. I've already mentioned Daniel Defoe, who wrote, for example, extensively about the nature of assemblies in places such as Maidstone and York, and said how they joined together both county society and also those who were, as it were, successful in urban terms. Successful towns saw not just new residential areas, brick-built buildings, which we've already mentioned, the light, roomy and attractive private houses for the affluent, but also public and philanthropic buildings, theatres, assembly rooms, subscription libraries, hospitals were all built, and very much providing a context in which local urban wealth played a key role. This was very different to the philanthropy and public buildings seen in many towns in the late medieval or early and late medieval periods, when much had been due to monastic foundations, for example, or to the crown in the form of castles and related buildings. The new buildings built in the 18th century often marked a major change in local consciousness, not least as a replacement for past settings of authority. So, for example, the new Guildhall in Worcester, designed by Thomas White and constructed between 1721 and 1727. Or in mid-century, Nottingham replaced its medieval timber-framed Guildhall by a brick one with a colonnaded front. Now, it would be easy for me, if I stopped at that point, to leave that remark as an instance of general improvement, which I might well have done if I hadn't been reading Daniel Defoe, because I noticed Defoe said of Nottingham, "There was once a handsome townhouse here for the sessions or assizes and other public businesses, but being overcrowded upon occasion of the assizes last year, it cracked. It must be said, I think, that Providence had more care of the judges and their needful attendance than the townsmen had. In other words, yes, there is a new guild hall, and yes, it is impressive, but also it reflects the, as it were, failure of the previous one and the failure of the town to look after it. More generally, the image of towns altered. Timber and thatch were seen as dated, unattractive, non-utilitarian, and increasingly non-urban, as were long-established street patterns. Furthermore, although some churches were rebuilt, new stone and brick buildings increasingly offered new definitions of town function, with an emphasis in particular on leisure and retail, and more generally on private space open to those who could pay. Ships, shops, subscription rooms, rather than spaces open to all, such as marketplaces and churches. New forums for sociability were certainly created. The influential assembly rooms at York, which I've already mentioned, were largely built in 1731 to 2. Assemblies were first held in Newcastle in 1716, and new assembly rooms opened there in 1736 and 1776. While Norwich gained assembly rooms in 1754. More generally, the townscape in some towns literally became brighter as street lighting was introduced, for example, on the main streets of Lancaster from 1738. Human noise was also focused on towns, as remains the case today. So, in his play The Relapse of 1696, John Vanbrugh, better known possibly these days as the builder of Blenheim, referred to London as that uneasy theatre of noise, which is a wonderful way of thinking about it today. Much of the froth of London politics or public demonstration means very little if you live in Loughborough or Lowestoft. Service activities, rather than industrial expansion, were the basis of growth in many towns. The economic basis of this shift was growing prosperity, especially in commerce, and this interacted with increased and differentiated consumption. Most of the non-food goods bought by affluent households were made in towns, and even more sold there or through them. For example, the Coalbrookdale Ironworks sold its pots, kettles, and firebacks through fairs in market towns such as Bishop's Castle, Congleton, Oswestry, and Wrexham, as well as to shops, including in 1718, shops in Birmingham, Bromsgrove, Evesham, Gainsborough, Ludlow, Macclesfield, Manchester, and Shrewsbury, so that the industry sat on a commercial network. Facilities for and patterns of service activity responded to the example of London without needing to be owned by London Capital. The metropolis was presented as the benchmark for conditions elsewhere, but it would be mistaken to ignore the provincial capacity to preserve local practices and to take initiatives. And in part, London's impact was itself a product of its openness to influences from outside. This element of its history tends to be downplayed, but it's significant to the interurban history of England, an element of its urban history that shouldn't be neglected. In other words, yes, London has an influence elsewhere, but we also need to be mindful of the way that other towns, and indeed the rest of the country, could indeed have an influence on London. Towns also benefited from the strength of the rural economy, which provided not only a commercial but also a social focus. A degree of urban-rural rapprochement and cohesion at elite level was an important factor, encouraging stability and also encouraging social life in towns. And as a related overlapping point, the urban population and the rural population both participated in the spectrum of politics. And although there were differences, indeed divisions, there was also considerable overlap with both political parties, the Whigs and the Tories, seeking to represent both towns and rural areas. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that the rage of parties and other aspects of political strife from the 1690s onwards were ones that both gave particular identities to some towns, but at the same time were ones that also, as it were, joined them to their neighbours, not least because of the need to act together in Parliament in order to pursue interests. Certainly the pursuit of interests in Parliament was something that towns could take an interest in. So, for example, the Birmingham Journal, the 21st of May 1733, records a Chester item. Saturday's post brought us the agreeable news that the petition against our navigation bill was defeated, and that the bill, that's the bill for the improvement of the navigation of the River Weaver, of course, and that the bill had passed through the House of Commons. This occasioned a universal joy in this city, which was expressed by bonfires, illuminations, etc. Two large bonfires were lighted and still continue burning, viz. One at the White Talbot, the other at Gloverstone, and will be kept in night and day till it pass the House of Lords, when they will be greatly augmented. Or again, the London Daily Courant of 18th of May 1734 reported of the election of Edward Thompson as MP for York. The company of substantial and loyal citizens that went with Mr. Thompson wore orange-coloured cockades. In other words, that was affirming their loyalty to William III, William of Orange, and therefore to the Whig background, the Protestant succession, etc., and carried a flag with the motto Navigation, in memory of his great service in obtaining a bill for the improvement of their river. And they hallowed, they shouted, Thompson, liberty and navigation. In other words, local politics, local interests was very much played out in the relationship between MPs and towns. I mean, Edmund Burke was famously to complain about being expected by the voters of Bristol to pay attention to them. Actually, that was the norm. Elections themselves could be, shall we say, rather disturbed. In 1730, a ministerial newspaper reported of an election in Winchester, a by-election. The populace rose in multitudes against many gentlemen who were voters, several of which had dirt thrown in their faces. Other coaches were overturned, while numbers who were guarded by constables and other officers met with the greatest disrespect. These days, one imagines that the Director of Public Prosecutions would have ordered the local regiment to open fire. 4 years later, Sir Robert Walpole wrote for Norwich on the day of the poll, great expenses made, great threats ushered in the day, but a due provision to repel force by force made it a quiet election. So much for the age of political stability, applauded by J.H. Plum. The Prime Minister, Sir Robert Walpole, sees stability as a matter of being willing to repel force by force. And the flavour of public politics was glimpsed at in a letter published in the Public Advertiser, which was a London paper, on the 12th of January 1757. Quote, I am the chairman of a club of respectable persons consisting of some gentlemen of fortune and some not inconsiderable tradesmen who talk freely enough at times of the public affairs, but always under a restriction that I am afraid is seldom observed elsewhere, namely to propose remedies rather than inflame complaints, and if even this with all the diffidence becoming public individuals. I think, as the correspondent noted, such conduct was extraordinarily uncommon. Aside from the centres of county government and or provincial culture, there were also important industrial towns, although their growth, as with Birmingham, owed something also to their role as centres of trade and distribution. On a long-standing pattern, these were closely linked to industry. The trading role was particularly important for ports. In the southwest, the ports became relatively more important. Sorry, that was a terrible phrase. I apologise, but that's me when I'm tired. The ports became more important. Plymouth replaced Exeter as the region's largest town in the second half of the 18th century, while Falmouth, which had been a small settlement in the mid-17th century, was Cornwall's largest town a century later. That's largely because Falmouth was a trading port. In fact, the packet boat, the regular service, went from there to Lisbon. Whereas the inland regional centre of and manufacturing centre of Norwich was the second most populous town in England in 1700, Liverpool, an Atlantic port that was not even a county capital, was in 1800. The county capital of Lancashire was Lancaster, although since its foundation in 1889, the county council of Lancashire has been based in Preston. Defoe himself was particularly impressed by Liverpool, praising it in his tour. Well, of course, it would fulfil all his ideal of commerce and industry and activity. Under the Liverpool Improvement Act of 1748, so that's after Defoe, a town commission was established and the new exchange confirmed the town's commitment to commerce. A charitable infirmary opened in 1749, which was a testament to the civic benefits of trade. We earn money, we're able to spend it on philanthropy. Other Atlantic ports had less spectacular or sustained growth, but nevertheless still saw a major rise in population. So Whitehaven's population rose to 16,000 in about 1785, significant coal exporting on the Irish Sea. Both Liverpool and Whitehaven, however, were also slaving ports. There was a major expansion in the slave trade, and between 1691 and 1779, British ships transported over 2 million slaves from African ports. The regulatory framework that had maintained London's control was dismantled in 1698, when the African trade was freed from the control of the Royal African Company, which legalised the position of private traders and made shifts in the relative position of ports far easier. Indeed, in the 1710s, the merchants of Bristol, who had long criticised the monopolistic role of London trading companies, replaced London in the leading position in the trade. In turn, Bristol was very hard hit by privateering, by Spanish and French privateers between 1739 and 1748. War of Jenkins's Ear broadens out into the War of the Austrian Succession. Liverpool, which is further away, literally that is important, and therefore less exposed to Spanish and French privateers, in turn took the leading role in the slave trade from the 1740s. Many smaller ports were also involved, including Barnstable, Biddeford, Dartmouth, Exeter, Lancaster, Plymouth, Poole, Portsmouth, Topsham and Whitehaven, the last of which sent about 69 slaving voyages to Africa between 1710 and 1769, when the trade was abandoned as unprofitable. The profitability, I mean, you can read my stuff on the slave trade, the profitability of the slave trade was very, very variable, which is why investment in, it's a terrible thing to talk about investment in enslavement, but there was investment of it in, it was often patchy. The country's largest industry, woolen textiles, benefited greatly from the opportunities provided by exporting cloth to West Africa, sold to West Africa, and in return for that, slaves obtained, and also to the slave colonies. And I think it's fair to say this sits very uneasily with our sense about this is a period of enlightenment. It was not only Atlantic ports that saw major rises in population. On the East Coast, Sunderland, North and South Shields and Tynemouth all benefited greatly from the export of coal, principally to London, and from coal-based industries such as glassmaking. Hull and Newcastle, both of which were more established urban centres, also saw major population growth. Now, coal-based industrialisation was significant in some towns also that were not those that I've yet mentioned. For example, Birmingham, where the first rolling mill was opened in 1740 as it became a major metallurgical centre. At the same time, it's worth noting, we mustn't, you know, run away with everything being coal, because water power not only remained important, but also increased, as when a large water-driven factory was opened at Derby on the River Derwent in 1721, foot by Thomas Lomb for his Italian silk-throwing machinery. More generally, the stocking industry moved from London, which was used obviously by men and women, moved from London to the Midlands, especially in Nottingham. And in 1750, there were said to be about 1,200 frames in the town. Now, it's, you know, so far we've been talking growth. But it's worth bearing in mind that some towns, for example, Oxford, Hereford, and Warwick, were all fairly static in many senses, in as communities and economies, while growth rates were relatively low in some formerly important centres, for example, Worcester. Other towns were affected by adverse economic circumstances. So Gloucester's trade, its sugar refining, its glass manufacturing could not compete with that of Bristol, and its cloth industry also declined. The net effect of such shifts was to accentuate the degree to which the urban network has always been one of changing character. I mean, if you think of the present moment in recent decades when Sunderland has suffered whilst Newcastle has done well, Leeds has grown more than Sheffield, Manchester more than Liverpool, and so on. The fate of individual towns was a matter of multiple factors. For example, York was hit in the 18th century by the growth of Leeds, but it was also able to benefit as a major centre for the local gentry, and again, unlike Leeds, to profit from developments in the trade in food. Leeds focused much more on textiles. York became in mid-century the largest national collecting point of wholesale butter and the provincial source of London's butter. This reflected the agricultural character of the lush grasslands of the Vale of York, and you know that indeed remains as very significant. Towns, particularly the major ones, constituted the living space of the most articulate and informed members of society, and tended to have their associated paraphernalia, such as printing presses. The press, indeed, is one index of urban success. Excluding London, the number of newspapers rose from about 24 in 1723 to 50 in 1782. There were failures. I mean, for example, Halifax and Darlington and Hereford found it difficult to establish newspapers. In Cumbria, although the first newspaper, the Kendal Courant, was founded in 1731, it was only when the Cumberland Packet was launched in 1774 that a lasting one succeeded, and other towns only acquired their first papers later. Carlisle in 98, Falmouth, the first in Cornwall in 1801, Barnstable, the first in North Devon in 1824. But what this serves to or indicate is, although progress was, it should not simply be judged by the successes. I mean, Bristol, Exeter, York, Leeds, Norwich, all major centres of the early press. Nevertheless, the direction, the trend was a clear one. As the foundation of newspapers indeed showed, it was not only the large towns that expanded, but many towns as well that were not in any way noted particularly in that respect. So Lieutenant Richard Brown wrote from the Isle of Wight in 1757, "Newport is a very clean, pretty town, regular and well built. The Bath players are in it, i.e. actors, and we have plays every night. Urban culture, urban improvement in the Isle of Wight. Overall, the growth in the number of schools, hospitals, dispensaries, infirmaries, theatres, reading rooms may not have been massive, but it was significant and it changed the institutional and cultural landscape, not only of the towns, but also of most of the well-populated regions in the country, and helped to accentuate the role of the towns within them. This was important to the period's self-image as an improving society." Now, such self-understanding should neither be taken at face value nor regarded as descriptively or analytically sufficient, but it did reflect something of the realities of 18th century life. We'll continue next time, but I think what we're talking about, and I hope throwing light on, is the way in which, although there were variations between towns, nevertheless, there was a fundamental trend of development. Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.